want to share a couple of things. And before we start, I want to apologize ahead of time. I've got a little cold, so I'm hoping I can get through this morning. As you see, I'm holding my water bottle, but I'll do my best to get through this morning without my voice cracking. But this week has been a very special week in a couple ways. Two anniversaries. Woo, that's loud. I'm going to have to turn that down, Clifford. Two anniversaries. One, Kelly and I, we have been married for 22 years. Can you believe she's put up with me for 22 years? I mean, you ought to pay her, you know, just putting up with me for that long. But I do want to say I am a blessed man. I don't say it enough before people, but God has tremendously blessed my life with my wife, with my family. It goes beyond words. And we know Scripture says, he who finds a wife finds a good thing. And I have truly found a blessing and a good thing with my wife, Kelly. But also, we are also celebrating another anniversary. I don't know, probably you're not even thinking about this, but I have been thinking about it this week. This week was our 20th year here with the congregation in Windsor. Actually, July is the month. I was looking at my logbook. I've got a logbook that I've logged all of my lessons, and I even write some little remarks in there. I started from my very first lesson, and it was July 18th. So a week or so ago, 1999, my first sermon in Windsor. And be careful what you say to me after my lessons, because I write under the remarks some of the things that you say. And in this one, I had written terrible. So all I said was terrible. So I don't know what that means. I just assumed that it was one of the worst lessons I ever preached, Ed. So I'm going to preach it for you this morning. No. It was titled Trailblazers, as Jesus, right? We know as our trailblazer or the pioneer, the one who has gone on before us, right? To show us the way, simply put. And so that's what it was about. It was out of Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, which you are familiar with. Now, in different circles, people will ask about longevity of preachers and their time being there. 20 years, and that's no record, but it is a long time. It's longer than most preachers at one place. But I know preachers like Robert Oglesby, who mentored us for years, who's been in one place for 55 years. Can you imagine? 55 years with me? That would be, take a miracle to spend that much time with me. But preachers will ask how you stay so long, and there's no secret to it, of course. And in all seriousness, it's not all about the preacher, and you know that. The preacher has something to do with it. Of course he does. But it's not all about the preacher. As you know, it is a partnership. It is a relationship between the congregation and the preacher and his family. I can remember back when there was a wall right here, there was a door over there, and we came around here. Ari, you remember that? And we had our meetings right back here where the baptistry is. One of the first things I said to the men in that meeting was, I want to be part of a family. That's what I want. And that's what you have allowed me to be, is part of a family. And Kelly and I felt like this would be a good time for us as a family to let you know how much we love and appreciate you. And it doesn't go without notice all the many things, many ways that you have blessed our life, the support you have given us, is truly an example of Christ. I was thinking this week that you have loved and supported us emotionally, spiritually, financially, of course. I couldn't do what I do if it wasn't for you giving to us financially. But emotionally, spiritually, financially, really, and this really hits home for me before we even had our children. Some of you have been here from, I think maybe Ari and Jennifer are the only ones that were here from day one, but there's a lot of you that were here before we had kids. I know the Likers were here very early on, the Mitchells and others that of you that are here also. But we go way back. I remember the three rows of rickety orange 1970s pews. Some of you probably remember those. They weren't even bolted down. If you weren't careful, you'd fall backwards. So, but I even remember back to that time. You have sent my family to encampments. We've gone to Red River for 17 years and other opportunities to renew ourselves spiritually when those times, when it has been allotted. And I was thinking also every Christmas you have given us generous gift to my family and so many other things. And some of you, and also in personal ways, have, all of you know who you are, but have supported us in so many ways. You've been patient. You've been forgiving when I've made mistakes, and I've made one or two. Actually, I've made more than one or two mistakes, but I just wanted to express on behalf of my family our gratitude for you and how much we appreciate you guys. All right, since my first sermon was out of Hebrews chapter 12, I went back and tried to find the outline. Maybe it's good that I didn't find it, so this is a fresh lesson. But we're going to take the same text, that one that I wrote terrible on, out of Hebrews chapter 12. So I'd like you to turn your Bibles there. And I actually, again, write down all of the lessons. I don't write down all of my classes or devos or those sorts of things. But anytime I preach or workshops or things like that, I write it down. And so this is actually my 1,269th sermon, for whatever that is worth. So some of those who've been at other places, but over 1,250 sermons that I have actually delivered. But we're in Hebrews chapter 12. And what we find in chapter 12, or all of Hebrews for that matter, as we look at a little background, is a warning for the Jewish Christians to stay faithful. Now, before we start reading some of these things, to stay faithful to Christ, before we start reading some of these scriptures, I want us to understand some of the challenges that they went through. It's very easy to read through a letter and to see how they lived and the mistakes they made when we're not in their shoes, right? Just like Israel in the wilderness, to go, well, how could they grumble so much and complain? Well, you know what? Chances are most of us would have, if not all of us, would have been in the same boat. We would have been grumbling and complaining too, because we do today. And we're not in a wilderness, a literal wilderness. And so we got to understand, they were not just lazy Pete Christians who were sitting back not doing what they were supposed to do. They had some hardships. And you need to understand that as you read this. Now, certain texts to help us understand their struggle, chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, is that text that talks about them drifting away from Jesus. The image and idea of a vessel drifting away, not being secure or not being anchored. And that's anchored. And that's the text that actually says, how will you escape if you neglect so great a salvation? Now remember, their influence and struggle seems to be going back to to the law and the system of the law. I think that was part of the struggle they were going through, but I think there were other things involved in that too. I think part of their struggle was persecution as well. Severe persecution. As we're going to read in just a minute, chapter 5, verse 11 says, they were dull of hearing at this point. Verse 12, you ought to be teachers. Remember, that's text that says, by this time you ought to be teachers. Now you are in need of someone to teach you again the elementary principles of the oracles of God. You have come to need not solid food, but milk, right? Remember that solid food, he said, was for the mature who, because of practice, have their senses trained to discern good and evil or right and wrong. But they're not growing like they should for some reason. And then verse 6 of chapter 12, they are sluggish, okay? So there's some laziness there, and those aren't all of the verses, but that just kind of gives us a taste of what's going on in the heart of these Hebrew Christians. And I think this word up here is a really big part of it, and that's apathy. How easy it is for apathy to set in and harden our hearts because the struggles and the trials that we go through in their life. They are clearly in danger of drifting, which just simply in our vernacular, they are in danger of falling from Christ. And they have to be careful. These first century Jewish followers of Christ are under a tremendous amount of pressure. We're going to notice that they've been assaulted. By the way, have you ever been assaulted for your faith in Jesus? They have. Okay, so keep that in mind. They have been plundered, or their possessions have been plundered. Have your possessions ever been plundered? Taken from you because of who you are and what you believe in? I don't think so. At least hasn't to me. I've never been imprisoned. I've never been ridiculed for my faith in Jesus. And I need to see that this is some of the hardship they have dealt with. And that will help us to understand why they are sluggish, why they are struggling as they were. I want you to hold your place there. I know we turned to chapter 12, but jump back to chapter 10 just to make my point again in their struggle. Chapter 10 and verse 32. Notice through verse 34, but remember the former days. This is when they were still Christians, okay? Early on in their faith. Maybe at the time of their conversion and shortly after. When after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings. Keep the word endured in your mind, okay? Because that's important to the Hebrew letter. You endured a great conflict of sufferings, verse 33, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations. That's trials. They were made a public spectacle for their faith, a mockery, right? And partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. Verse 34, for you showed sympathy to the prisoners and you accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Does this sound like a struggling group of Christians? They were on fire. They were enduring. They were being Christ followers, faithful Christians. I mean, they were allowing their properties to be taken and their possessions taken, looking to the better possession of their eternal goal. And they were going through those things, church. So keep that in mind as you look at this. I like in one of the commentaries I read, it's called The Message of Hebrews, a very easy to read commentary. Raymond Brown said this, and I thought, boy, this is so fitting. He said, no believer can cope with adversity unless Christ fills his horizons, sharpens his priorities, and dominates his experiences. See, somehow, for some reason, I think Christ was not filling their horizons. He was not sharpening their priorities anymore. They were losing sight of it. He was not dominating their experiences and their life for whatever reason. And I think hardship, I think going back into the Jewish system, part of the persecution was a result of that. It wasn't just that there were Jews saying, hey, come on over here because the law's better. There's a lot more involved in what they were going through. And again, I want you to keep this word in your minds as we go through this lesson. And this is where the application is going to come into our life. Because we all need to endure. We all need to keep on keeping on because the race is not over. We're back at chapter 12, okay? We're going to start reading there. And actually, hold your place there. Because where chapter 12 begins, he's starting off where he left off in chapter 10. We just read verses 33 and 34. Look at verse 35 and listen what he says. Therefore, you went through all those things. Do not throw away your confidence. They're a confident people, but for some reason they're in danger of throwing away this confidence, which has great reward, verse 36. For you have need of endurance. So they're weakening. So that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. For yet in very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. Verse 38, but my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. God doesn't want anybody to shrink back. Verse 39, but we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. You know, I was listening to this and I'm hearing a halftime or a third quarter pep talk from the coach. You're a tough team, right? Those of you who played sports, you can get this image. And this imagery will be in chapter 12, by the way. So I'm not making it up. Maybe not football, but endurance of an athlete is here. And it was in the mind of the writer. But I was thinking about football, and the coach would gather you around. You're a good team. Maybe you're in playoffs. And he sets you down. He says, listen, guys, you're a fourth quarter team. You all as players know what he meant. You're a fourth quarter team. But right now you're not playing as a fourth quarter team. You're in the, it's halftime, and you played good in the first half, but the second quarter you were horrible. You're lagging. You're weak. You're sloughing off, whatever words he would use. I hear that here. You got to be fourth quarter people. You've got to go till the last whistle blows and there's no more time on the clock. And that's what he's trying to urge them to as we look at this section of Scripture. Now, let's look at verse 1 of chapter 12. Therefore, he says, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. One thing you will notice here, I think the writer is saying, is that there are going to be certain things, Hebrews, that you are going to have to reject. There are always going to be things that we need to reject in our lives. Now, the way that he words this is almost like he's saying, don't miss what I'm saying. Make sure you get this right. You have a great cloud of witnesses that have surrounded you. They've already gone on. And who's he referencing? Back to chapter 11, right? That's our faith chapter. Of all those lists of faithful people who were obedient even to the point of death. And they gave an example that you could finish this thing, and you even see some of the things that they went through. Verse 32, listen to what he says. And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong. They became mighty in war and put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting their release. So in essence, he's saying, remember, there are your brethren who have gone through what you're going through, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And a better is a key word in Hebrews. Go study that sometime. And others experienced mockings, scourgings, yes, chains, imprisonment. They were stoned, sawn in two. They were tempted, and they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And all these things, these having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. Actually, apart from Christ, there is no perfecting of anyone. Remember, we're going to see he is the author and the perfecter of our faith. So you have this great cloud of witnesses. Some say you can even get the image of those that are in the stands cheering us on, church. Keep going. We did it. You can do it. And so the cloud of witnesses surrounding us is showing us the way that we can do this. Then notice what he says. He says, lay aside every encumbrance. Did I say there are things we're going to have to reject? Actually, the encumbrance gives us the idea here in this section of an athlete. So those of you who have been in sports, you can understand this actual image. And we know that when training starts or before our event, whatever it is, we have to prepare ourselves. The body needs to be fit. And there's some excess weight we've got to get rid of. You know, football, I'll use that image again, is starting right now. And those guys enter into training camp and some of them are too big. Guess what the coach wants to do? He wants to get rid of everything that's going to be an encumbrance. The excess that is going to keep him from being who he or who she is supposed to be, depending on whatever athletic event that is. And you think about encumbrances. What are encumbrances? Well, what isn't an encumbrance if we let it get in the way of our faith? And we know that sin easily entangles us. And we know what our sin is, but what encumbers your life? What is excess in my life? Are there people that are hindering me? Are there relationships? Is it my job? Is it my thoughts? What is it that is hindering, is becoming an encumbrance? Could it be my money? It could be anything, church. There are things encumbering them and getting in the way, and he's saying you got to lay it aside. And then he says you got to lay aside the sin, which so easily entangles you. Now think about, again, well, let me just say this. I remember as kids, you ever tie your shoes together in a race? It's kind of comical, isn't it? We used to tie our shoelaces, me and my friends, and we would race, right? And what happens? Those feet get going real fast, but you don't go very far. Upper body gets moving forward, and you do a head plant, right? A face plant. That's like us in the church with sin. That was like the Hebrew Christians because of sin. And he's saying you got to lay that aside. Think about those of you like track or runners. And you get in there and imagine, you know, usually you might tighten your shoes. But imagine if you decided to just get at the line and say, I'm going to tie my shoes together. That's silly. But that's what sin is like in our life. It's like an athlete tying his shoes together when he is trying to run. And that last part, you'll notice what he says there of this verse, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, which leads us to our next point. There are certain ways, or a certain way in which we have to run. There's a certain way the Hebrew writer says, Christian, you've got to run this way. There's no other way to run. It's the only way you can run. And that way that you run is the way of endurance. Understand that the faith is never a sprint. Actually, the image is of a grueler. You ever been in a grueler? A grueling race? So tired and exhausted you felt like you were going to die? That's the idea. If I could put the Greek word up here, in the original language it says, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run the agona. Agona. That's the race. You know what that word is in our English language? Let us run with endurance the agony. You know, in sports we say the agony of defeat, right? The agony. That's our English word, comes from this word. He's saying you have entered the agony. That's what the Christian race is. And I think we begin to really feel that and understand that the longer we try to live out our life of faith, and we understand discipline has to be involved. We understand that training has to be involved. Matter of fact, I know that this is not in the context of some of the sports that I've mentioned, and clearly not in the context of hunting, but it is about endurance. I had a friend, for you hunters here, he was scouting this last week. He's going to go archery hunting for elk later on this summer. And he sent me this video of about 200 head of elk that he found scouting. And he had to go way back. He said, I was 5 miles back. We saw elk from 5 to 12 miles. He said, we passed some real tough terrain starting at 6 miles back. That's where we're going to begin to hunt. And we're going to go uphill by 2,000 feet. So this is some really tough stuff. And so here's what I responded. He said, we passed all these rivers. I lost 7 pounds. It was tough. I said, dude, if you get one of those elk down, you better eat it next to the river. He said, every morning I get up and cover 5.5 miles on my elliptical on high resistance uphill setting. I'm hating every step of the exercise, but it's working. I'll be in elk shape for sure. Why does he say I hate every step of it? It's about endurance. It's an agony. It's a grueler. I love sports. I admire endurance athletes. I'm not one of them. I struggle with it. But I admire them. And that's what this is about. Being that one that endures through all things. And we need to endure. Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:8, for bodily discipline is only of little profit, but godliness is profitable for all things, since it holds promise for this life and the life to come. That's why Paul told the young preacher Timothy, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. By what you teach, you're going to ensure salvation for yourself and for those who are going to hear you. We got to hear, but we got to endure. There's hardship. But then we get to chapter 12 and we get to verses 2 and 3. And let's finish up our lesson. He says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, the pioneer, the forerunner, the trailblazer, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. And he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God, for consider him who has endured. You hear endurance there again and again? He endured such hostility by sinners against himself so that you and I will not grow weary and lose heart. Why did he do that? Why did he go through what he did that we don't give up? So we endure as he endured. Right? Let us run with endurance. So here's our last point. There's a certain place we have to look. I mean, what person enters into a race and says, I'm going to look wherever I want to look? I might pay money to watch that race. You don't do that in a race. You have a goal, you have a finish, and you are the runner is looking directly there, straight ahead. He doesn't look to the left, does he? He doesn't look in the past. He doesn't look to the right. He's, with everything he's got, he's focused. Concentration of tremendous effort on the end, the goal. And what's the goal? Christ has already done it. He's our goal. He's our finish line. He's what we're looking to. He's paved the race and showed us how to run it already. We've got to just follow him as the image. We got to fix our eyes upon Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. And then he said, let us consider him who endured such hostility. And again, I think this goes back to, he wants us to be fourth quarter people. That's why he did it, what he did. That we do not grow weary, that we do not lose heart in this race. And so there's a few things for us to take with us. First of all, there are certain things that we have to reject. Only you know what you have to reject. What's your excess baggage or weight in your faith? You got to reject it because it's an encumbrance. There's a certain way in which you've got to run. You can't run your own way in your own race. And it's an agony. It's an endurance race. You got to train. You got to work. You got to endure. And then thirdly, there is a place in which we have to look. And that place is the finish. It's the fixating our eyes upon Jesus. Brown in his message, as we conclude, said, finally, Christians must look away to Jesus, the patient sufferer. They must consider him lest they become exhausted. That's a good word for this lesson. Exhausted. They might be mocked, assaulted, scourged, forsaken, handed over by informers, imprisoned, falsely accused, and even killed, but so was he. They must consider him and his endurance in the face of such bitter hostility. lest they become exhausted in the race. Our author uses two vivid words when he writes about the danger of the first word, growing weary, and then faint-hearted or losing heart. Listen to what William Barclay wrote. He actually quoted Aristotle, who used this same idea of growing weary and losing heart and looking to the goal, this concept of the Hebrew writer. Here's what Aristotle said. He uses a little odd wording here, but just hear him. Of an athlete who flings himself on the ground in panting relaxation and collapse after he has surged past the winning post of the race. Do not collapse before you surge past the finishing post of the race. That's the message. We want to encourage you, church, and even friends that are here, and if we can this morning, we have an invitation. We want to pray for you, whatever your concerns or needs might be. Maybe you've decided you're not in the race and you're ready to be in the race, to become part of it. There is a tremendous award beyond all that we understand on the other side. You need to be baptized into Jesus, be clothed with Christ, put him on, be forgiven of your sins to become part of that race, part of his family, and walk faithfully with him. If we can encourage you to do that this morning, let us stand and let us sing the invitations.